Today, it's Mad Max versus the housing market. Hello again, it's Marcin Oth from Digital Finance Analytics. Well, the latest post covering finance and property news. Well, I'm pleased to say that after my computer failure for the live show on Tuesday, Leith is back for a recorded show, which we're going to put out later on today. Hey, Leith, nice to see you. And sorry about the technical issues the other day. But I tell you what, we have a few technical issues in the economy at the moment, don't we? And I think the housing market is in the crossfields.
Mate, it's the housing market. It's the overall economy. I think it's the unemployment rate. Not yet. But I think we've got a whole lot of, reality checks coming for the Australian economy and for the housing market, unfortunately.
And I would argue that clearly some of the global impacts are hitting all economies. But because of dumb decisions that have been taken in Australia over the last 20, 30, 40 years around productivity, the housing boom, the lack of oil storage onshore, all of those things, well, it's all coming home to roost now. And I'm seeing the politicians running around with headless chickens at the moment saying, don't panic. But actually, there are some really quite worrying signs. The RBA, of course, put interest rates up again. And the markets are saying, oh, they're going to put them up even more. Although I have a feeling that at some point they're going to go, oh, no, we need to cut again. But it is tricky to navigate. And I'd be very interested to get your latest take and your latest data that you've been working on.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think there's some good analysis to be done around obviously the interest rate story, but also the energy story, which is Australia's right in the crosshairs there through idiocy when you got to be quite frank, but also the immigration story. We got some interesting immigration data last week and also some rental data that came out. And then on the flip side, we also got immigration data across in Canada, which also has some important insights for our market. Well, not really insights for the market, but it should have insights for our policy makers. About what they can do to actually solve the housing crisis in a realistic manner, rather than just this supply thing, which is, let's be honest, with this interest rate shock that's happened and the energy shock, it's going to be even harder to build homes now. So yeah, there's a lot to talk about.
Yeah, so Leith, it is a very, very important time to have this conversation. And I think what I'm finding interesting is that a lot of the information is being quite heavily filtered in the mainstream media. And I think some of the issues that we're going to touch on today may be a surprise to some people. For example, the latest migration data was, stronger than a lot of people said, more than 300,000 migrants over the last year. Surprise to no one, really.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's pretty interesting. So I've got some great charts here just on the whole housing issue with migration. Now, Jared Minnick, who's an absolutely excellent independent economist. He used to be the chief economist at Morgan Stanley. He's gone out on his own. He's got his own advisory now. But he put out some really good charts last year, and actually might have been the start of this year and last year, the two separate reports. And they basically showed the impacts of high migration and population growth on Australia's housing market. Now, the chart on the left comes from Jared Minnick. Now, what that shows is basically he's plotted the house price appreciation versus population growth across a whole bunch of economies. And he argued that basically population growth isn't the sole driver of home prices. Obviously, we've got interest rates and all this other stuff and borrowing capacity, whatever. But he attributed the excess performance or the excess appreciation in countries like Australia, Canada, New Zealand, etc. A lot of that is to do with the fact that these sorts of countries run higher migration programs than other countries. So although the whole world's housing markets have risen quite a lot this century because of the decline in interest rates and increased borrowing capacity and the Basel II capital accord and all this sort of thing, population growth actually explains a lot of the outperformance of these sorts of markets. That's the chart on the left. And the chart in the middle plots basically population growth against the CPI rental growth. And you can see there's a pretty strong correlation there. Not surprisingly, you bring more people in. Migrants who come into Australia tend to rent first. So they'll rent for years and then they might buy down the track if they stay. But obviously, if you're going to import hundreds of thousands of people every year and into a market that has trouble supplying enough homes for that, it spikes rents. And you can see there's a very strong correlation there between rental growth and migration, and I've just added my own chart on the right-hand side, which kind of captures this explosive immigration period that we've had, whereby advertised rents since the end of 2019, according to Cotality, they've gone up by 47%. And that's basically added $11,500 per year to the cost of renting the median home in Australia. So if you think about that from a cost of living perspective, so Cotality estimates in the last 5 years, advertised rents have risen 3 times faster than wages. So that's, not surprised, the reason that the fundamental reason why Australia's a rental crisis. We've run this massive migration program, especially in the last several years, and that's put this upward pressure on rents. Now, we got some migration data from last week from the Australian Bureau of Statistics. So we got two sets of data. They're similar but different. So at the start of last week, we got the monthly net permanent long-term arrivals data. So what that basically is, that measures intentions of travellers. So when people come to Australia on a plane, they have to fill in passenger cards, and that's the same if we go to other places around the world. And you basically have to state if you're a tourist, or if you're say a permanent resident returning, or you're someone who intends to stay in Australia on a long-term basis, which is 12 months or more. And the net permanent long-term arrivals data basically measures permanent migrants who are coming in, or returning citizens, plus those who intend to stay in the country for 12 months or more. And you can see that's captured top left chart there in the red. You can see that net permanent long-term arrivals figure in the year to January was basically the equal highest we've ever had in the nation's history. It was just under 500,000. In fact, the month of January, the actual monthly figure, was the highest January in Australia's history for the month of January. Now, that isn't net overseas migration. So net overseas migration is actually based on observed behaviour. So what that does is that then looks at people and only counts you as a net overseas migrant if you've been in the country for 12 out of 16 months. Yeah, 12 months in a 16-month period. But irrespective, net overseas migration, which is shown in the blue, has also rebounded. So it was 311,000 in the year to September last year, which is the most recent data that we've got. And that's actually up from about, I think it was 306,000 in the year to June. So it's actually rebounded again. And just to put that into perspective, yes, that's down from the recent peak, but that would be the second highest migration figure, net overseas migration figure in Australia's history before the pandemic. So we only beat that once and only slightly in, I think, 2008, 2009, when we did about 315,000. So this is historically high migration numbers. And you can see from the middle chart, I've actually plotted the daily net overseas migration per day in office, right? Under the last five governments, if you count the last five governments based on party. So not, Hawke Keating is one government, Abbott Turnbull Morrison one government, et cetera. And you can see that in the first 3 1/4 years of the Albanese government, which is what we have data for in net overseas migration, we've had 1,145 net migrants arrive per day under the Albanese government. And that's almost double what we had under the Abbott Turnbull Morrison government, if you exclude the pandemic. So we've only gone up to the end of 2019, so you leave the border closures out. It's nearly double what we had under the Rudd Gillard government, which of course was big Australia. It's basically nearly triple what we had under the Howard government and nearly 4 times what we had under the Hawke Keating government. So this migration that we've had has been absolutely extraordinary. And this is obviously, we haven't built enough homes for it. And as a result, we've seen the rental vacancy rate, which is shown in the chart in the top right by Cotality, has collapsed to a record low. We've just seen, as I showed in the previous chart, advertised rents have soared by 47% since the end of 2019. That's added about $11,500 to the annual cost of renting. So that's absolutely smashing renters. The bottom right chart there from Cotality basically tracks the annual growth rate. And you can see that after the growth was falling last year, it was still high, it's actually rebounded again. So annual growth's gone to about just over 5.5%, which is higher than wages. So that just means that this rental affordability problem is going to continue to get worse. And one of the kickers, and this is the chart on the bottom left, comes from Tarek Brooker, who, obviously you're having the show every 2 weeks. Tarek did a great chart where he actually plotted the Cotality's advertised rents, year-on-year growth, against the net permanent long-term arrivals numbers. And actually, instead of tracking net overseas migration, it actually tracks the net permanent long-term arrivals. So That to me is pretty obvious. So net permanent long-term arrivals counts people that are in Australia who intend to be in the long term, but not necessarily if they stay. So if you only stay for 11 months, you're not counted as a net overseas migrant. But if you stay for 11 months, you still need housing. So you impact the rental market. And you can see that the recent growth on the net permanent long-term arrivals has tracked the growth in the asking rents, which tells you that it's net permanent long-term arrivals that has more of an impact on the rental market than net overseas migration. Net overseas migration is a subset of that. Now, why this matters is that Treasurer Jim Chalmers last week, he told the press that the budget is going to actually upgrade the net overseas migration forecast. So the federal budget for this current financial year that we're in, which is 2025-26, had previously forecast that net overseas migration would be 260,000. Treasurer Chalmers now believes that in 2025-26, it's going to be above 300,000. So obviously in the first quarter of this financial year, it was tracking at 311,000 annually. He now thinks it's going to be stuck above 300,000. Now that matters because as the chart in the bottom middle here shows, that's the latest forecast from the National Housing Supply and Affordability Council. The National Housing Supply and Affordability Council forecasts that we'd have a cumulative shortage of homes over the 5 years to 2028-29 of 79,000. But that was based on Treasury's population forecasts, which again, forecast net overseas migration of 260,000 this financial year. Now, Treasurer Chalmers has said that it's going to be over 300,000 because obviously migration's higher than what they thought. What that means, if you actually look at that chart there in the bottom middle, the National Housing Supply and Affordability Council actually had alternative scenarios. Their baseline was for a 79,000 shortage over 5 years. But they said that if population growth is 15% faster than what Treasury expects, instead of having a 79,000 shortage of homes, we're actually going to have a 200,000 shortage of homes over 5 years. Now, based on what Treasurer Chalmers has said, he expects net overseas migration to be over 300,000 instead of 260,000. That's roughly a 15% increase, right? It's close enough. Well, and so that basically means, according to the federal government's own National Housing Supply and Affordability Council, that the housing shortage is going to be even worse than they projected last year because net overseas migration is going to be higher than what the government projected. And all that means is that the rental crisis, which is already insane, we've got record low vacancy rates according to Cotality, is more than likely going to get worse. And part of the reason why it's going to get worse is because, and we'll talk about this later when we talk about inflation, but we're likely to actually build less homes now because we've got high interest rates and obviously the cost of materials and everything's going to go up because of the oil shock and the energy shock, which makes it even harder to build homes. So we're bringing in more people at the same time as we're more likely to even build less homes than what they expected, which just means that the housing shortage is going to get even worse. This is absolutely dastardly stuff. And I can get into it in a second, but there's a complete polar opposite example that's playing out right now in arguably what is the most similar economy to Australia, which is Canada, which is doing the exact opposite thing. It's crazy.
Yes, and the fact that he's talking about budget reform in May, et cetera, we're going to be, doing stuff that is really important for the future, despite the fact that, in fact, they've down forecast now productivity growth, which again is suggesting that they're going in the wrong direction. But they're actually adding extra people to the country at an ever faster rate. And we've talked about, the quantitative easing by people rather than actually financial. But at a time when, because of the Gulf War and because of the higher costs of fuel and the lack of availability of fuel, and that will knock on through manufacturing to a bunch of broader supplies in the building industry. There was an example of Reece plumbing materials going up 36%, I saw the other day. It is nuts. We have a government that is actually running an agenda that is actually anti-Australian, in my view.
Yeah, absolutely. And actually PropTrack, which is the REA group, they put out their annual rental affordability report. I think it's either annual or it's biannual, but they put out their latest report last week. And shock horror, I've got some charts here, but they showed that Australian rental affordability is just like Cotality. So I've got Cotality's data, which is on the left-hand side, which are my charts. And that was from Cotality's September quarter of last year, housing affordability report. So it was released in December quarter, but it was for up to the September quarter. And you can see that, you know, Australia's rental affordability as of the September quarter of last year, according to Cotelity, was tracking at its worst level in history. So that's the top left chart there, the percentage of median household income that's required to be spent to rent the median home. It's never been worse, according to Cotelity. And that again gets down to that advertised rent surge, which I've repeated on the bottom left, which I showed before, you know, the 47% increase in advertised rents. Well, PropTrack actually put out their data, which measures it differently, but, you know, tells exactly the same story. PropTrack said that, again, rental affordability is at a record low. So they've got a different sort of index, which is the percentage of people that can afford to spend, I think it's 30% or less. The percentage of homes that are available, I think, that are available for less than 30% of income or something. But that's basically at a record low. They showed that the share of affordable rentals is at a record low. PropTrack, that's the bottom middle chart. Their median advertised rents, according to them, have actually increased by about 50%. So it's actually higher than Cotelity's. But again, look at the chart side by side. You've got Cotelity's the bottom left, PropTrack's the middle bottom. They tell the same story, right? Rents have surged. And the worst thing is only about PropTrack estimates that only about 2% of homes, and that's the bottom right chart, affordable to people on lower incomes. So, you know, no matter which way you cut this, the rental crisis is out of control in this country. And the primary reason why it's out of control is because the government is bringing in far more people than there are homes. And that's pushing rental vacancy rates to you know, historical lows. And it's driving rents through the moon. And they are, the Albanese government is literally spitting on renters by doing this ridiculous policy. And it's making, obviously, the housing situation, especially for renters, far, far worse. Now, here's the rub, Martin. Last week, as we got Australia's migration data, which showed that migration's rebounding and still at this historical high level, we also got the fourth quarter Canadian migration data. So Canada runs 3 months ahead of us. So they've obviously got a more efficient, you know, Stats Canada is probably more efficient than the ABS. The ABS, we get our migration figures 6 to 9 months behind. So they're always so far behind. Canada seems to be 3 to 6 months behind. But anyway, so Canada released their immigration and population growth data last week. And what it showed is that annual population growth, the change in population recorded its first annual decrease in recorded history. And that's the chart in the middle there. And they actually lost 100,000 people last year, Canada. So the Canadian government basically, I've got a chart there on the top left, and that's taken from early 2024, right? So that's from the National Bank of Canada, which is one of the big major banks in Canada. And that chart was from, I think, February 2024 when I took that chart. And back then, Canada was running an absolutely insane migration program, and it had record population growth. And you can see there what it did to the rental market. The population growth spiked, rent spiked. No surprise, right? But the difference is the Canadian government recognized the error of its ways. The immigration program became very unpopular. They had a massive rental crisis. Infrastructure was all crush loaded. You know, all the problems you have when you bring in far too many people than, you know, more people than you can actually absorb. And their government, partly because of political pressure, but also because they realized the error in their ways, they decided to effectively freeze Canada's population growth. And the way they want to do it is they want to reduce the share of temporary migrants in Canada from a peak of 7.6% in, I think, May 2024, down to 5% of the population by 2027. And they're already part of the way through that. So they're naturally sending temporary migrants home now, and they're trying to shrink the number of temporary migrants in Canada. They've also reduced the permanent migrant program by about 25%. So Canada's deliberately cut immigration, and obviously it's bearing fruit because the population declined by 100,000 last calendar year, which is its first decline in at least 60 years of records. And guess what? It's worked, because as all the charts on the right show, which comes from rentals.ca, Canadian rents have fallen for 17 consecutive months. They're down nearly 7% from their peak in 2024. And it's now saving the median renter in Canada $172 per month So the typical renter in Canada now is paying $172 less per month to rent a home than they were at its at the peak. And rental affordability in Canada, which is basically the percentage of income, the percentage of median income required to rent the median home in Canada, has fallen from a peak of 34% 2 years ago. It's now at 29%. That's the bottom right chart, and you can see it's at its lowest level, at least in a decade. We don't know how far that chart goes back because it's only going back to 2020. But you can see that it's, likely probably the lowest level in about a decade. So this just shows you, the rents in Canada are now tracking at a 33-month low. Rents are down nearly 7%, and or roughly 7%. And Canadian renters are now saving $172 per month because their government decided to cut immigration and basically freeze population growth. And as a result, they're solving the rental crisis. Whereas our idiot government is keeping migration incredibly high. And as a result, it's making the rental crisis even worse. And obviously, according to PropTrack, according to Cotality, we've got the worst rental affordability in the nation's history. And now, because of this fuel crisis we've got, this energy crisis we've got, this high inflation shock we've got, and high interest rates, we're less likely to be able to build homes because the supply side is going to be even more constrained. So, wouldn't the logical thing be to do if you, when you've got a shrinking supply side and the supply is more constricted, you've got to cut demand to meet that? But our government is instead, according to Jim Chalmers, immigration is going to run, at least 40,000 higher than what the budget forecast. Well, that's 40,000 more people that need housing or need rental accommodation. They're just making the situation worse, Martin. It's ridiculous.
It is. And the latest from my survey shows that the mortgage stress is about half of households, but rental stress, in other words, cash flow pressure in the rental sector, is still up at 75%. So a lot of people are really finding it really difficult to make those rental payments and are having to cut back on other things to be able to do it. And that's before we see the immediate impact of the inflationary pulses which are now coming through. And, everyone's now expecting inflation to be quite a lot stronger. Even Jim Chalmers has said, what, 5% possibly, although that's probably an understatement based on what I'm seeing. And there are modeling assumptions now which suggest that the inflation pulse could be quite a lot stronger than that. At the same time, as the overall economy is going to get strangled, which of course then takes you into a stagflationary environment. You do not want to be bringing a whole bunch of additional people into a country that's facing into potential stagflation. It doesn't make any sense.
No, and potentially mass unemployment because this that there's two main things here which are likely to send unemployment significantly higher, right? So first of all, is a bit of a structural one, right? So we know artificial intelligence has been rolled out across the world. Tim Tui, the chief economist at Yarra Capital, put out some analysis about a week ago on Livewire, which I wrote up on Macro Business a couple of times or once, and then covered some other stuff he said. And he forecast that Australia's unemployment rate, just because of the AI shock, could rise to about 6%, because he reckons AI is going to replace a whole bunch of jobs in a whole bunch of areas. And the people who are basically made redundant because of AI, replacing tasks, et cetera, and they're not going to be able to retrain and get other jobs quickly. Right, especially in this lower, we're likely to have a lower demand in environment with high interest rates and some other stuff that's going to happen, and also just the energy shock, et cetera. But so he forecasts just because of AI, we're likely to see unemployment creep higher to about 6%, and I think he settles over like a 2 year period. Right, now that's the AI shock. The other shock is the energy shock. Now, the reason why I'm so worried about this, obviously, we've got a global energy shock. It's impacting all nations, right? But Australia is particularly exposed because for two reasons. First of all, our ridiculous government decided to ignore the International Energy Agency's requirement for countries who are members of the International Energy Agency, and we are one of those, to store at least 90 days worth of liquid fuels. To have at least 90 days storage, right? In case there's a supply shock, which like we're currently having. The Australian government, in its infinite wisdom, despite the fact that Australia is isolated from the rest of the world, we are an incredibly large country which requires a lot of diesel to basically transport everything around. So pretty much everything, when you go to a supermarket, every single good that's in that supermarket has been delivered to that supermarket via a diesel truck, right? And it might have come from overseas via a ship on bunker fuel, which is diesel. Or it's come in on a road freight, sorry, a rail freight train, which is powered by diesel. Everything is diesel reliant in Australia to get goods from overseas or from the country areas, whatever, where we make food or factories, whatever, into the supermarkets, which is where we buy stuff. Or, you know, any other kind of containerized freight that comes in, whether that's TVs and computers or whatever, it comes from overseas on a ship powered by bunker fuel, which is diesel. Onto rail freight or road freight, and then into Harvey Norman, whatever, right? So we're very diesel dependent because we're also a very large country. We need a lot of transportation. Also, we need a lot of aviation fuel for that reason. And also, because of the structure of our economy, we're agricultural based, well, very agricultural based compared to other countries. And also, we're very mining based. Diesel powers the agricultural sector, tractors and all the farm equipment, everything, all powered by diesel. Mines, all powered by diesel, right? All that heavy equipment that transports your iron ore around and crushes and rocks and all that stuff, it's all diesel powered. So Australia is, you know, probably one of the most diesel dependent countries on earth. And if diesel stops, literally farms, crops will wither in the field because they can't be harvested. We've already seen farms now saying, look, we're not going to bother planting this year's crop because we don't have going to access to the fuel and it's too expensive. That's a bit of a worry. We've seen some mines, like in WA now, basically lay off their staff and go into you know, temporary shutdown because they can't source diesel. And we're likely to start seeing shortages in shops, etc. Or there's also been reports now that garbage collections are going to be impacted because the diesel-powered garbage trucks, there won't be enough fuel for that. So we are literally facing a situation because we've only got 30 days of storage of all this stuff. And some of that's even stored over in the US. It's not even here in the country, whereby the entire economy could effectively seize up because of a lack of diesel. Now, if you lack petrol, it's an inconvenience, right? If I can't drive my car, which is petrol powered, around, oh, well, you know, it's annoying. It's obviously going to have an economic impact, but the main impact is diesel because the whole Australian economy runs on diesel. If you don't have it, you got bare shelves in the shops, farmers can't harvest, mines can't operate. Stuff can't get transported around. It is absolutely critical for this country. Now, so we're because of our idiotic policymakers that A, didn't have enough storage, and B, have allowed Australia to basically go from having seven fuel refineries back in the early 2000s to two, we've become wholly reliant or almost wholly reliant now on importing processed fuels from Asia. But now we're seeing that being obviously crimped from the, you know, Strait of Hormuz, which is the main supplier of oil to Asia, which then we buy refined fuels from, aviation fuel from China, which they've now cut off. You know, petrol and diesel we get from Korea, Malaysia, Singapore. Those are now in doubt. So Australia faces basically the economy going into some sort of meltdown, a diesel-induced meltdown because we don't have enough diesel, which will then obviously crimp economic growth, be inflationary because higher fuel prices just feed into everything. Probably 50% of the goods in the CPI basket are impacted by fuel, not necessarily directly, but as a second-round impacts because it's an input cost. And we're seeing that with, as you mentioned, with Reece. Like Reece Plumbing has jacked up its rates by 30% because of fuel. We're going to see that across a whole bunch of areas now. So that's inflationary, which is why we're going to head into this stagflationary environment. So we're facing slower growth, much higher unemployment, but also this stubbornly high inflation, which is why obviously the RBA is hiking. And this is a absolutely disastrous situation that we're facing. And I've just got a few energy charts which are interesting. I'll just show them quickly. I kind of just talked about it here, but the chart on the left-hand side, and I think Tarek's probably presented this one because we've both used it on Macro Business a few times. But basically, that shows the national oil stockpiles across developed countries, and that's based on the International Energy Agency's 90-day minimum requirement, which is that line which goes down the middle. You can see that Australia is the only one there which doesn't meet the 90-day requirement. We've got about, you know, just over 30 days. The other two charts I've got there come from the Australian Energy Update, which is basically produced every year by the Australian government. And what it shows is Australia's primary energy use by fuel source. That orange line is the important one. That's basically oil. So oil is petrol, diesel, aviation fuel, effectively. And you can see the chart on the right there. It's just showing that our oil consumption, or through those liquid fuels, has just risen inexorably, pretty much for, since the mid 1980s. It just goes up and up and up because as the population's gotten bigger, we need more of that stuff to transport things around. And the chart on in the middle there basically shows the share massive lightning strike. It just scared me. The middle chart there shows the share of energy by source. And you can see that despite all the hoopla over renewables, they actually supply less than 10% of Australia's energy use. But liquid fuels or oil is about 42%. And of that 42%, so of all liquid fuel use, about 56% of that is diesel, right? So even if Australia magically replaced every single passenger vehicle in the country with from petrol and diesel to electric, it would only reduce Australia's liquid fuel use by about 25%. And it would have very little impact on diesel because the overwhelming majority of cars in Australia that are using an internal combustion engine are petrol-powered cars. And the problem here is diesel, right? So this whole notion, oh, we can just electrify everything, doesn't work, right? And it's certainly not going to work in the next 15 years. We are a diesel-dependent economy, and unfortunately, we're about to run into diesel shortages, which is obviously going to create massive problems for the economy and could end up shutting down a large parts of the economy and creating shortages everywhere and basically having redundancy and much higher unemployment, let alone the AI shock. It's a pretty bad situation.
Yeah, and just to add to the story of farming, of course, not only is it oil, and particularly diesel, but also fertilizers. And once
Yeah, of
again,
course.
Australia is very dependent on importing fertilizers, and the fertilizers predominantly come from the Middle East. And what that means ultimately is all the chemicals that create the fertilizers, which means again that farmers not only don't have diesel, but they don't necessarily get access to the fertilizers. So crops this year, which are, winter crops would be being prepped now, we're going to miss that. So there's a potential issue with regard to food later. But it's not just Australia. All countries are in a rather similar boat to a greater or lesser extent. So it's going to be a bit Mad Max. Who's going to actually grab the resources? Who is not? Who's going to be able to pay more or not? And the bottom line is that the policies that the government have run for the last 20 to 30 years, particularly around energy, are a bit crazy. And you mentioned the US, though there was at one stage through Scott Morrison a plan with regard to holding fuel in the US that could then. Now, my understanding is, and it's a bit confusing as to precise, but they sort of turned the policy around and it was then held in Geelong and Brisbane. And they also counted in the 30 days the stuff in transit. So actually in the tankers coming down, which is why, of course, it's now the tankers are not coming or not as fast as before, means that there is a countdown to a point where effectively things ain't going to be very good. It's also worth noting, by the way, that if you look at LNG supplies, because Netherlands was on that chart that you showed right at the top with a very significant supply of oil, but they've got almost no, about 5% of LNG at the moment because the Netherlands is very reliant on LNG imports. So other countries are going to be impacted differentially. In Australia, of course, we are still shipping out some LNG, although it looks to me as though some of the issues with regard to diesel could actually impact that before long in any case, funnily. But also, price of LNG rise means price of electricity
Yes.
rises,
So
right?
there's an interesting story there. So look, personally, we can't do anything about the mess up of not having enough storage, right? That's already happened, and the government policymakers have completely stuffed that up. And I'm hoping that, say this war miraculously ends in a few weeks, which I don't think it will, but I hope it does. I hope our policymakers learn that, okay, we're going to make energy security priority number one, two, three, four, and five. Forget about this net zero rubbish. Like, energy security is number one. So yeah, here's the thing. What's the point of having a military if you don't have the fuel to power that military, right? We might as well just not have an army. Because if you don't have the fuel to go into your war machine, what's the point, right? We're completely defenseless. So that energy security has got to be top priority here. And what will happen if we don't remedy this situation? And you know, it might mean signing some more strategic reserves with the United States, right? So Angus Taylor, when the former government did actually some of our 30-day reserves actually over in the US, and we're getting some of those shipments now. But you know, if we don't have the physical capability to store this stuff in Australia right now, well, we should be doing it over the US, and they can under contract and whatever, pay them whatever, so that they can transport it to us when it's needed. Because what I'm worried about is if we don't learn from this, what happens when China invades Taiwan, right? Which I think is a pretty good likelihood that'll happen in the next few years. We're gonna have the same problem all over again. Like, you know, assuming we stay out of it, and we just let them, you know, do whatever they want with Taiwan. But the global seaways, so you know, our oil refined fuel shipments from Malaysia and Singapore, and China's obviously not going to give it to us, you know, but also Korea, they're all going to be stopped. So we're going to have the same problem again. So we need to solve this problem for the next time, because obviously we're stuffed it up this time. But what Australia should do this time around is, like, you know, I'll use Korea as an example. I'm picking on Korea here, but Korea is one of our main markets for selling liquefied natural gas, right? So they buy a lot of our LNG exports. They're also one of our main markets for purchasing these refined fuels. This should be quid pro quo. So we should make Korea guarantee that it's going to continue to supply us with refined liquid fuels in return for us guaranteeing that we'll continue to supply it with LNG. And if it doesn't continue to supply us with refined liquid fuels, well, then we should withhold LNG. Because there is an LNG shortage at the moment as well, because Qatar, which is basically the equal second biggest exporter with us, we do about the same volumes in the world after the United States, has basically been knocked out, right? So we've lost those exports. So there's a massive global gas shortage as well, which is probably even worse than the oil shortage for those countries that need it. So Australia's got leverage there. We should be leveraging that to ensure that we guarantee petroleum supplies, petrol and diesel and aviation gas, from the countries that use it. And I also think we should be doing that with China, because China's now said that they've now banned exports of aviation fuel. They're one of the suppliers of our refined aviation fuel. But guess what? Most of Australia's East Coast gas goes to China. So why aren't we withholding our LNG from China to say, okay, if you want LNG, quid pro quo, you got to supply us with aviation fuel. Like, you know, this should be quid pro quo. And if we leveraged our LNG exports, we could guarantee that we continue to get petrol and diesel imports and aviation fuel. And if we do that, the economy won't seize up. Like, it will still be expensive, but at least it won't seize up. And so our policymakers need to put energy security as the top priority here. Like, forget about all this net zero rubbish and all that. Like, I don't think people are really concerned about that sort of thing now, when they see literal oil fields exploding and people attacking each other with missiles and big smoke plumes and all that sort of stuff. It's like, come on, we got to get serious here. Like, energy security is national security. It should be the primary focus of our policymakers, not all this wishy-washy stuff that, let's be honest, isn't going to make a rat's of difference when other countries aren't doing it anyway. It's crazy.
Yeah, well, the craziness continues if you think about the RBA. And, you know, is the RBA going to effectively create a GFC version 2 on the back of their strategy? Oh, we didn't get inflation down. Oops. Oh, it's taken a rather long time. Oops. Oh, actually, inflation's still sticky. Oh, we need to put interest rates up. And now she's talking about the R word, recession. So I'm afraid the RBA is part of the problem too.
Yeah, and I honestly think we're going to repeat the GFC experience. Just as a bit of a primer or background for people who, I don't know, weren't around at the time, whatever. But back in late 2007, the US experienced the start of its subprime mortgage crisis, right? So it hit the US, and that began in late 2007. And back then we had, you know, sort of slightly stubbornly high inflation. We had a pretty strong economy. We had the mining boom going on, etc. And the RBA, it lifted interest rates four times into the subprime mortgage boom. So they lifted it from when that started to just before the GFC in I think the last rate hike was probably June 2008, but they did basically four rate hikes, so 1% increase in the cash rate, and that's shown in the chart on the top left there, the left-hand side. You can see they jacked rates four times here. Now, what happened is the official global financial crisis started in September 2008 when Lehman Brothers and Bear Stearns and those ones all collapsed. And that sent, we had a 50% decline in the share market, and obviously it was going to be economic Armageddon, credit market seize, all that sort of thing. And the RBA ended up cutting rates by 4%, which is that massive dip here, 4%. Now, I'm not saying we're going to get 4% rate cuts again, but I can see the RBA doing a similar sort of process. So we've obviously had two rate hikes already. The financial markets, and that's this little bit on the end here of this chart. Basically forecast another three more rate hikes now. So they're priced in another three more. So that means if that comes to fruition, we would have had by the end of the year, five rate hikes, 1.25% increase in the cash rate in one single calendar year, less than one calendar year, because it started in February. Now, I've got some, and there are some reasons why the RBA is obviously very concerned. So this week we got the ANZ Roy Morgan Consumer Sentiment Survey, and you can see the middle top chart there. There was a massive rise in consumer inflation expectations. That's the blue line. It absolutely jumped up. The orange line is delayed because that's the February consumer sentiment survey from Westpac Melbourne Institute. So we haven't got the latest figures yet, but the blue one's done every week, and you can see that consumer inflation expectations have surged. The RBA will be very concerned about that because, if people expect inflation to go up, well, they'll try and demand bigger pay rises and blah 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 when they talk to their employers. But the other thing that was concerning was that you can see that in the right-hand side there, according to Roy Morgan, the consumer confidence index was the worst since like the early 1970s, or at least in 50 odd years of records, like 55 years of records. So consumers are really glum at the moment. Their consumer confidence has completely collapsed. But consumer inflation expectations have gone up. So this is that sort of inflationary, that stagflationary environment you're talking about. Now, if we did end up getting five rate hikes this year, I've got two tables there at the bottom, which are based on the average sized first home buyer mortgage as of the December quarter. So the average size first home buyer mortgage was 607,500. That's based on the latest ABS data. That's as of the December quarter of 2025. The average sized overall mortgage was $736,000 in the December quarter. What I've done there is I've shown basically the mortgage repayments before the RBA started hiking rates, which when the discount variable mortgage rate was 5.5%, versus what it would be if 100% of the cash rate hikes were passed on to mortgages, which seems likely, right? So if the mortgage rate was to go from 5.5% up to 6.75% after five 25 basis point rate hikes, the typical first home buyer, and the reason why I'm saying first home buyers, because obviously the government brought in the 5% deposit scheme. And you can see on the bottom left chart there, which comes from the latest RBA Financial Stability Review, there's been a big jump in high loan to value ratio mortgages. That's that because a lot of buyers jumped in on this 5% deposit scheme, which came in on 1st of October. So they've leveraged into the market just before the RBA was going to hike rates or started hiking rates. And now the markets are predicting five rate hikes this year, which is going to increase mortgage rates by 1.5%. What that means for one of these people who's taken out the average size first time buyer mortgage of 607,500 is that their monthly repayments are going to go up by a cumulative $491 per month versus what they were before the RBA hiked rates. That's an incredible hit. So that's nearly $6,000 a year of after-tax money that they've got to come up with just to service their mortgage. And for the typical mortgage, the average new mortgage holder of $736,000, the monthly mortgage repayments would go up by nearly $600, so $595. Right, so that's what's that over 7 grand extra money after tax you've got to find to pay your mortgage. That's it. That's a hell of a hit. And I'm most concerned about the first home buyers who borrowed 5%. Leveraged up. Obviously, if you're borrowing 5%, you're taking out a massive loan. And then now did that thinking at the, start at the end of last year that we weren't going to get many rate hikes or maybe none at all, or maybe just one or two. Suddenly they're looking at staring down the barrel of five rate hikes and potential house, well, likely house price falls Well, very likely a house price falls in at least Sydney and Melbourne this year, and probably going to some of the other markets like Brisbane later on. But you'd be very scared if you were a first home buyer right now who leveraged yourself thinking that you weren't going to get much, rate hikes, and you're thinking that prices are still going to go up, to a market that has completely changed in not even 6 months, to suddenly already having two rate hikes and the financial market's expecting another three. So you're staring at another nearly $500 a month extra mortgage repayments if you just took out the average size mortgage, and potential heavy price falls in places like Sydney and Melbourne. So Louis Christopher, in his latest house price forecast, he forecasts that Sydney and Melbourne are going to fall this year, and that's his base case. But in his scenario two, I think he called it, which is if the RBA hikes rates above 4.5%, the cash rate, which we're already at, what is it? I just lost track. 4.1% now? Yeah, 4.1. So if we get two more rate hikes, we're going to be above what Louis Christopher says. And the financial markets think we're going to be at 4.85 at the end of the year. Well, his scenario two analysis was that Sydney and Melbourne are going to experience heavy price falls if that happens. You'd be pretty worried if you'd be pretty concerned if you say geared up into a Sydney home, took out a mega mortgage on 5%. Now you're facing a massive mortgage squeeze and potential negative equity a year later because prices are going to fall by more than 5%, which was your deposit. It is an absolute disaster scenario we got here. But the only silver lining, well, it's not really silver lining, it's just going to happen for bad reasons. But I think because the unemployment rate's going to rise, significantly, not just from the AI thing, which is probably a 2 year period, like Tim Tui said, but also this energy shock. If this war doesn't resolve quickly and we have the diesel shortages and then we start having shutdowns across various areas of the economy, we could see a pretty nasty recession, both globally, but even nastier here because we're so diesel dependent, we have so little fuel. And then that could be the GFC moment where the RBA goes, oh, okay, we've got stubbornly high inflation, but the decline in economy and the rise in unemployment overrides our shorter term concerns about inflation. So we're going to cut rates. So that's why I think there's a good chance we could have a sort of repeat of the GFC whereby the RBA hikes and hikes and hikes into the recession, and then suddenly the recession hits and it hits hard, and then they've got to quickly cut rates to try and, stem the bleeding. And I think I wouldn't be surprised if the federal government throws policy or money at the housing market again, which is what they always do. But part of the reason for that is they've created a rod for their own neck because they have literally encouraged first home buyers into the market. They've guaranteed 15% of their mortgages under this 5% deposit scheme. They won't want to see house prices tank and these people basically go into negative equity or some of them lose their homes and be going mega mortgage stress because they encourage them into the market, right? So they've almost got now a financial incentive to try and prop the market up to cover for their stupid policy. So we'll probably get some action there down the track as well. Some more stimulus somehow for the housing market to try and prop up house prices. But that's basically where I see things there. And I actually think the RBA is making a mistake hiking rates now. Now I get why they're doing it, and obviously their main concern is inflation. That's most of their mandate is, obviously it's full employment as well, but the unemployment rate now is currently still low. So they're looking at the rise in inflation. They're going, okay, we've got to, we've got to hike to stem inflation. But I just think they shouldn't have hiked at the latest meeting. It was a very close call. Obviously, five members voted in favor of hiking, four voted against. But I think just given what's going on in the world and this pending energy crunch that Australia's facing, the diesel crunch, really, I think it could end up being foolhardy. And I think that's why they're going to repeat what they did in the GFC, where they hike and then go, oh, whoops, and then slash. And I wouldn't be surprised if towards the end of the year, second half, they're actually cutting rates because everything's gotten so bad.
Yeah, well, I'm expecting that too. But I think also, home builder version two, and help yourself to some more superannuation funds to be able to throw into property. I mean, all of those things are, well, it's a playbook that they used through COVID. And my own view is that we are just as we were in the early days, the foothills of COVID. We're not sure how severe the oil spike will be, but we know it's going to be serious. We're not quite sure how long it's going to go on for because, Trump could, well, even if he decides to stop, it doesn't mean it will stop, because
No.
Iran, you know, actually, as long as it survives, it wins in a way. So it's not just in the gift of Trump to do a taco. That, all that says to me is that the amount of uncertainty that we've got at the moment is hyper, hyper strong. And therefore, the RBA then turning around saying, oh, we should put the rates up anyway, bit foolhardy. I understand the inflation argument. But yeah, they're going to have to change their strategy later. Meantime, of course, mortgage holders who suddenly find that their jobs are not there anymore because, well, they work in industries where they need diesel and they're not getting the diesel, we're going to potentially have more hardship. And I wouldn't be surprised again to see if we see the banks, you know, handing out largesse and being allowed to forgive and forego, etc. All the same stuff as last time. So the same playbook through COVID. The question is, will it be enough to do what they did last time, which was ultimately to give a massive rocket to housing prices subsequent? I mean, you know, 30%, 40% up in the year or so after COVID. I worry they're going to make the same mistake again, and we're going to end up with even more of a disaster for the housing sector and all of this too.
Yeah, absolutely. But there is also the alternative in that the it might just not work because, you know, I realize the immigration story is different. And I always, whenever I do these things, I think, oh, gee, I wish I put those charts in, because I actually wrote a article today on macro business for basically the gist of it was, you know, it was something about an overseas lesson for Australia on housing, which is basically, so what I did, I can't remember the title of it. It sounded a lot better than that. But basically what I did was I think it was housing lessons from abroad or something like that. So I basically profiled Canada and New Zealand, which both have had real house price falls of above 30% now. You know, declines from peak, their most recent peaks. And again, Australia is a pretty similar economy to Canada and also New Zealand. We've got the same banking system as New Zealand, but I'd argue that we're even more structurally closer to Canada. And both Canada and New Zealand, which are the two most similar countries in the world to us, have had severe house price corrections, or crashes, really. If you do it in real terms, they're crashes, right? So what's to stop Australia going down that road? Now, the big difference between us and them is that we, New Zealand and Canada do have, they have been building more than population growth because obviously immigration into both countries has collapsed. So New Zealand had very sharp declines in immigration. It was still positive, but it went down from a peak of about 130,000 per year down to a trough of about 10,000. And it's currently about 14,000 a year. So they've had a massive decline in immigration. At the same time, they've kept building at similar rates as they were before. And now they've got, their rents have also fallen in New Zealand, and obviously they've fallen in Canada as well, because they're the big decline in immigration. Canada's house price is similar. They've also tanked. Now the Bank of Canada and the RBNZ are both cutting interest rates, but it's not doing anything with the housing market now. So, you know, there are examples overseas where you go, well, it's not working now, and their housing markets have corrected. And I think now people over there expect prices to fall. Whereas in Australia, it's like nobody expects prices to fall. And if they do, it'll just be a little dip, right? And it'll rebound again, like it always does. So, yeah, there is a chance that this time we actually do get a severe house price correction or crash, like New Zealand and Canada have, or like the WA had after, you know, 8 years after their mining boom, before the current run up. They had a big correction slash crash as well. So, yeah, it is possible, but at the same time, the government could rescue it again, and we could have another surge upwards, and then just more unaffordability and a bigger malinvestment and rinse and repeat the same stuff that you and I have been talking about for 10 years. Who knows?
Yeah, and it's just worth saying that on long-term averages, property prices in Australia are at least 40% over long-term value, you know, and the amount of debt in the housing sector is huge. And of course, our banks are completely leveraged up into housing. So in fact, if prices started to fall, there could be financial stability issues coming through as well. And that could also reflect in what the government and what the Reserve Bank does too. So it's a very complicated situation. But, you know, the point as we come towards the end of the show, Leith, is that we are now reaping the whirlwind, right? We are effectively exposed because of bad policy decisions around migration, energy, housing, well, in fact, pretty much across the board, right? We have stuffed ourselves up royally despite the fact that Australia should be one of the most wealthy countries in the world based on the energy footprint that we've actually got in the country if we'd done things right. The question is, will we learn the lessons, or will, as you say, we just rinse and repeat and effectively, you know, well, we've got to keep housing prices up at all costs. So, you know, we'll do everything else and never mind. We'll keep migration high because that's what we've got to do. And we'll have to borrow more, of course. That means that the debt burden is going to go up, which means, of course, that more of taxation is required. So you can see that this spiral of same old could be one outcome, or will it actually be a turning point when we actually have sensible people in government thinking, actually, we can't just go through this same cycle again. We need to go somewhere different. That, for me, is now the real critical point about whether we get to Mad Max or whether we don't get to Mad Max, and whether, in fact, it's the housing sector that's saved or whether the housing sector ultimately is thrown under the bus to save the broader economy. And I don't know where it's going to play out, but, boy, it's going to be interesting.
Oh, absolutely. This is grab the popcorn moment. I was talking to Tarek the other day and he said, oh, mate, just because I'll say, mate, I think this is going to get really bad. And he's just going, oh, yeah, I'm just grabbing the popcorn. Like, he goes, mate, you can't do anything about it. Just sit back and just watch the, you know, just sit back and watch the show. There's nothing you can do about it. And, you know, I agree with him. And he also wrote a really good piece. It's on macro business, which was actually pretty interesting. So he said that, isn't it funny how the Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese, now is blaming the petrol shortages or the fuel shortages on excess demand now, right? Yeah. From people panic buying. Hmm. So he suddenly discovered the demand side of the market and he's blaming the demand side. But then when it comes to housing, he can never mention the demand side. It's all supply, 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 right? He's got a complete blind spot, has nothing to do with immigration, which his government controls, and is pumping like there's no tomorrow and now expects it to be higher than they budgeted for. But that has nothing to do with the housing market. But now the fuel crisis, oh, it's all about excess demand because people are bringing forth the demand, they're panic buying, stuff like that. It's got nothing to do with supply. Like, it's just funny how the, you know, politicians just, you know, massage the message to suit their needs.
Well, that's true. And of course, I was amused by the Reserve Bank governor buying another investment property, right?
On the day of the rate hike.
Exactly. Look, which, so Australian.
To a credit. Look, to a credit. I'm never going to come out and, you know, congratulate someone on $1 million salary who does this sort of stuff and lives in a complete different world to the rest of us. But, you know, at least I'm assuming she voted in favor. I don't know, but at least the RBA raised rates at the same time as she's buying a property, which notionally goes against the value of a property, or if she's taken out a mortgage, which probably hasn't because she's on a massive salary, whatever. And she actually owns several investment properties as well. You know, of course, like most politicians and these other senior bureaucrats, they own heaps of properties, right? Mm-hmm. So her and her husband apparently own multiple investment properties as well. But, you know, they have at least hiked rates against their interests, I guess, because, so, you know, I can't, yeah, I'll at least give her that.
But my point is that there is a bit of an us and them thing going on here, right? So if you're a politician, or if you're actually a CEO of one of these large corporations being paid millions, you know, the few percent, they're pretty much insulated from all this anyway, because they're going to find ways around it.
I was going to say, mate, it's sorry to cut you off, but it's actually it's public servants in general. So, you know, obviously most of the jobs that have been created in the country, the 2/3 of them since the start of 2013, or 69%, the latest data, has been the non-market sector, right? So that's public service and government-funded jobs, et cetera, yeah. And, you know, healthcare and all this other stuff. But especially the public service. We had a massive bloat in the public service in the last, you know, since COVID, huge increase in numbers across the federal bureaucracy and the state bureaucracy. Those people insulated from this stuff, right? Yeah. They never lose their jobs. Or rarely. Or if they do, they get a massive package and it's voluntary redundancies and stuff. And, you know, that's obviously one of they're one of the reasons why productivity stinks. We've got too many bureaucrats just, you know, doing whatever. And whereas the market sector, the private sector of the economy is actually struggling. They have been for a long time. And that's another disconnect we've got. We've just got too many people now in Australia now reliant on the government for their income rather than the private sector driving the economy, which is how the Australia was that I grew up in. Like, we used to have entrepreneurs, and growing up, it used to be, you know, the private sector drove the growth and the And the government funded sector was just a small part of it, right? They were just there in the background because you needed them to do certain tasks, whatever. But now it's like the government funded sector is now driving the economy and the private sector's getting squeezed. It's just that there is a us and them dichotomy now in a whole bunch of areas.
Absolutely. Well, of course, it's a bit the same in the US as well, with the few percent doing well and everybody else not, and as in Australia and other places too. And it's all by design, really, unfortunately. So I think we're at a very, very important inflection point, and I appreciate your sharing your thoughts today. If people want to find out more about you, where's the best place for them to go?
Yeah, two places. So macrobusiness.com.au is where I write articles every day. Myself and Dave Leland-Smith and Tarek Brooker, he does an article every day for us as well. Go there if you want to read sort of written analysis, that sort of thing, and charts and this kind of stuff. But if you want to see hear my many rants on interviews and podcasts and that sort of thing, go to my YouTube channel. If you just go type in Leith Van Onselen, that's what it's called. It's called Leith Van Onselen. Very original. You can just watch interviews and that sort of thing. I do heaps of radio and lots of stuff now. I do all sorts of media and podcasts and radios, and these sorts of chats is kind of what I do a lot of.
Terrific. Well, thank you very much. And I'd like to get you back on the live show next month. So we'll tick-tack on the dates. But I think the technology is now sorted out. And apologies for the stupidity on Tuesday. But I blame Microsoft. Unfortunately, they forced an update, and I spent an hour trying to sort it and couldn't. So
it's the
anyway.
most frustrating hour of your life as well.
Oh, it is.
No doubt.
You know, you sort of watch the clock counting down. Thinking, I can't do this. I can't do. And we tried a few things. Anyway, we got there. Anyway, so thank you, Leith. I think this is a really important time to have this conversation. So many uncertainties, and I look forward to the next conversation down the track. Thank you very much.
Yeah, no problem at all. Speak to you next time.
Cheers.